Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In my experience, there are few people who have a better grip on the nature of that war in its various component parts than a man that I'm very pleased to have with us. It's been a while since we have had his participation in this program, I'm sorry to say, but not for want of trying, and we're thrilled that we've succeeded in not only getting him back on, but also getting a full hour of his time. His name is Søren Kern. He is a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute and writes brilliantly there with regularity. He is also a senior analyst for the Strategic Studies Group in Spain. He served in the United States Air Force in the last decade of the Cold War, was stationed in Germany, and has a very keen grasp of what's going on in the continent of Europe and what it means for not only its people, but also for the rest of the world, including this country. Søren Kern, thank you for joining us again. It's so good to have you back, and thank you especially for giving us an hour of your time. I want to start, Søren, with some of the writing that you've been doing of late from your vantage point in Spain about the impact of this so-called coronavirus, COVID-19. I think of it as the Chinese Communist Party virus. But how is it going there? Europe has lost something like 100,000 people, I believe, to this disease, with some countries having done rather better than others. Give us just sort of a 30,000-foot view of the affliction of Europe at the moment and its impact.
Sure. The situation here in Europe is devastating. It's clearly nothing has happened here on this continent since the Second World War that's anywhere near comparison. There's not just massive deaths, and you mentioned 100,000 deaths. There's a lot of differences in the way different countries count the numbers of deaths. So I'm sure that number is twice or possibly three times higher than what the official statistics say. That's very clearly the case here in Spain, where there's been, you know, efforts by the government to sort of play down the extent of the crisis. The other side of the coin is really the economic crisis. It's just devastating, particularly for the southern European countries like Spain and Italy. This will take really a generation for a country like Spain to recover from this. And we haven't really even begun to see the economic crisis in its full bloom. So right now, there have been a lot of very generous handouts from the state to try to get people, to get through the quarantines. But once the quarantines are lifted and, the extent of the damage, economic damage, becomes real, the debt, this is something that is going to be very, very difficult for Europe to overcome anytime in the near future.
So the hangover, if you will, of this virus, as you see it, is likely to be in the debt, as well as presumably what we're experiencing here, too, which is the massive bankruptcies that have taken place, many of them among smaller businesses, that by some estimates will really never recover. Is that a concern as well in Spain and Europe?
Sure, particularly here in Spain, the country is very, very heavily dependent on tourism. Possibly up to 25% of the economy in regular and irregular employment is dependent on tourism. The country has been on complete lockdown. If you look at, Flight Aware, it's a program that allows you to see the airspace. You can see over the United States that flights are everywhere. But if you look at the map of Spain, you won't see an airplane in the sky. And so there are no flights coming in from Germany or Northern European countries, normally the wealthier countries that bring in a lot of money here to Spain. So I am afraid that many hotels and restaurants will not even open up this summer. And because it costs more to try to open up the hotel than, not have any people come. So we're seeing millions of people really being pushed into poverty. And I'm very fearful of crime. Spain, in general, has been a relatively safe country up until now. But when you have millions of people who are out of work and the government is unable to provide for them, you know, we're talking about the social welfare system in that context, and then people will get desperate. So I'm afraid, really, when the lockdown here in Spain is lifted and people are free to roam out, that we're really going to see a very dramatic increase in insecurity here.
How extensive is the lockdown at the moment? Is it comprehensive and countrywide, or has there been any effort to begin easing it as we're seeing here in the United States?
Sure. The lockdown here in Spain, I would say, has been arguably the most strict lockdown of any country in Europe. It's been really total confinement for 40 or 50 days. People are allowed to go outside to buy groceries or to go to the pharmacy, but there are really police patrols everywhere. And I think the government is really, since it doesn't have any tax revenues coming in, it's trying to issue as many citations to people as possible, because that's only the real revenue coming into the state right now. Now, on Monday, the May 11th, some parts of the country have opened up, particularly the Basque Country and some rural areas. But the major population centers like Madrid and Barcelona and Valencia are still on lockdown, and really there's no real idea about when these large metropolitan areas are going to be coming out of lockdown.
Soren Kern, let me just ask you about one thing quickly before we have to take a short break. Nancy Pelosi, as you may know, Speaker of the House here in the United States, has introduced legislation, the fourth round of the so-called CARES Act, one feature of which that is beginning to get some critical scrutiny is the idea of essentially providing an amnesty for illegal aliens in this country who are providing what are broadly described as emergency services. And I saw a piece that you wrote at Gatestone on the 12th of May, in which you address a similar kind of effort underway in Europe. Talk quickly about that, if you would.
Sure. The Italian government, you know, Matteo Salvini, of the more conservative League Party, left the government in September. A new government took over, a leftist government, and they've just now agreed to give a blanket amnesty to 600,000 illegal immigrants in the country. Portugal has given a blanket amnesty. Based on those examples, other European governments have come under increasing pressure also to give blanket amnesties, including France and Spain. So we're talking really about millions and millions of people who are illegally in Europe are really being offered an amnesty with social welfare benefits that far exceed, in some cases, people who've been paying, you know, indigenous Europeans who've been paying into the system for all their lives. And so I think this is really going to create a backlash against migration, even among people who were generally, you know, not opposed to mass migration. But in the context of economic calamity here in Europe, when you see millions of people who've arrived here illegally, who essentially are not working, receiving these very generous benefits, it's going to create a backlash. And the so-called far-right parties, the populist parties, are almost certainly going to gain traction.
Hold that thought. Soren Kern, we have to take a brief break. We'll be right back with much more from the distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, Soren Kern, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're visiting this full hour with a remarkably astute observer and chronicler of events in our, well, I call it war for the free world. From his vantage point in Spain, but with a broader vision of both the continent of Europe and global developments that should be of concern not only to freedom-loving people on the continent of Europe, but to all of us. His name is Soren Kern. He is a distinguished senior fellow of the Gatestone Institute, where he writes regularly and with great effect. He is also with the Strategic Studies Group in Spain, and we're catching up with him there. Soren, again, thank you for your time today. We're talking about this phenomenon of immigration in Europe, and some of it illegal. What's the theory that your governments in Spain and elsewhere in Europe are applying to this notion that in this environment, with all of the difficulties associated particularly with public expenditures, they should shower hundreds of millions of euros easily on illegal aliens?
Sure. The idea in most European countries is that these people are needed in, you know, in the case of the coronavirus, they're needed to be farmhands and to pick the crops and to take care of the elderly. In the reality of the situation, I think that a lot of the European governments who are contemplating these are left governments. The Spanish government, for example, is a coalition of socialists and communists. Unbelievable, but true. And so I think that these governments are coming under an extreme amount of pressure from activist groups, from NGOs who are very in favor of mass migration and of sort of the open borders in Europe. And that's also the case with the Italian government. So my calculation is that the Italian government wants to bring in, wants to legalize 600,000. But the farm unions, the unions, they say basically that there's a shortage of only 200,000 workers right now. And so these other, you know, 400,000 workers, it's really an excuse that these European governments are using really to use this coronavirus crisis as an opportunity to advance a political goal that's been, you know, very long-standing, and that's to bring in a lot of people from, you know, other parts of the world, non-Europeans, non-Christians, as a way to sort of create this multicultural society, and that really is continuing apace, really.
I suppose this is the same animating philosophy for Nancy Pelosi and her Democrats as well, so this shouldn't come as a surprise, but it is chilling nonetheless. Søren, speaking of non-Christians, you have for years now been providing incalculably helpful, and I dare say very courageous, accounts of what is happening with the essentially unassimilable Muslim populations that have been migrating to Europe, many of them illegally. One of the things that has been striking, and I particularly have appreciated the writing of one of your colleagues at Gatestone, Guy Millière, about the lockdowns in Europe, at least in France, having essentially been suspended by that country's government in order not to have the so-called banlieue, the special urban zones, or sensitive urban zones, as they're called in French, erupt in violence because they will refuse to observe the lockdown. And then that could trigger, well, who knows, civil war. Could you give us a sense of how that's playing out both in France and whether this is a phenomenon more broadly that, again, sort of plays into, I'm sure, this larger agenda of trying to appease and accommodate the illegal aliens with, you know, rather generous subventions by the state?
Sure. In the case of France, the authorities are very afraid of a repeat of the 2005 riots. Those were sparked when two Moroccan or sort of North African youth were fleeing from the police. And while they were running away, they jumped into a, you know, an electric box substation and were electrocuted. And that really set off riots throughout the country for a long, several weeks, 3 or 4 weeks, and created massive amounts of damage. Now, a few weeks ago, a North African youth was on a motorcycle racing like at 10 o'clock at night in the wrong direction on a street, and he crashed into a police car, and he ended up breaking his leg. And what happened was that immediately this guy contacted his friends through social media. We have his riots in France accusing the police of provoking this accident. As it turns out that this North African youth, actually he's 30 years old, so he's really not a youth, but he has he's been arrested 14 times for, robbery, for physical assault, for threatening to murder someone. And he's been cited 3 times since the lockdown for violating the lockdown. And you have all of these groups, these left-wing groups in France that are anti-police, who are sort of piling on the pressure, making the police to be, you know, the perpetrators And the criminal, I guess you could say, is the victim. And so what you have is really the French authorities are very, very afraid of having another series of riots. So in all these banlieues, all the suburbs, particularly in the northern parts of Paris, the police have been instructed not to enforce the lockdown. So, you know, we had Easter, and we had Passover for the Jews and Christians, but during Ramadan, where the Jews and Christians here in Spain and other European countries were not allowed to celebrate this year because of the lockdown, but you have the double standard of where you have the Ramadan and in France, and all of these people are allowed to be out on the streets with, you know, with very minimal police enforcement.
Whereas if you wish to worship at your church in Easter, not so much the case, you would be allowed to do that.
Sure. Here in Spain, for example, there have been very strict enforcement of the closures of Catholic churches. Some priests carried out masses, and the police actually went into the church during the mass and, you know, arrested these people. But then in parts of Barcelona and parts of Madrid, the Muslims are allowed to do their, you know, Friday prayers on the streets without social distancing, essentially without any interruptions from the police. So you see these sort of double standards that were have been very common all along continue throughout the coronavirus lockdowns. And I think that is also creating a lot of, you know, a lot of resentment among normal people who've been essentially confined under really seriously legally dubious manner for a very long time, and you see these double standards. I think this is going to have serious political backlash.
And I want to come back to that because it's obviously a leitmotif here for a lot of what's going on. But Soren, just to stay with this thought for a moment, there is a degree to which this is obviously just an affront in the sense that it's a double standard, that the taxpaying citizens of the country are held to very, very harsh quarantine circumstances, and these others, many of them illegal aliens, are not obliged to do that. But there's also a public health issue, is there not? I mean, are these people, when they are freed from the lockdown, essentially still confined to their no-go zones, for want of a better expression, or are they able to move about the country more generally as a sort of special privileged persons?
Sure, I really don't know about the effects of, you know, maybe a second wave resulting in some of these banlieues. Or what I know is, for example, in Germany, in the state of North Rhine-Westphalia, it's the state with the largest number of immigrants, particularly from Turkey and from North Africa. And that is also the state that has been the most impacted by the number of infections and the number of deaths. And so it really remains to be seen, you know, if these, you know, these double standards do result in a second wave of infections in some of these areas. But right now, it seems to me that there's been relatively little social interaction between. It's not that easy to move from one part of the city to another part of the city in a lockdown situation. Here in Spain, we live near the Central Park, and there were some Pakistanis who essentially were violating the quarantine, and they just set up their home here in the middle of the park. And so the police did come a few days ago and cited them and took their tents and took their things away. And so at least here in Spain, it seems to be that there is some attempt to enforce evenly the lockdown. But, you know, time will tell how this whole thing really, really developed.
Let me ask you about the larger problem. Soren, we will take a brief break in a moment, but the problem of the unassimilated, predominantly Muslim immigrant population, of course, was very much an affliction before the coronavirus. These circumstances, have, you said, I think, exacerbated the situation. But just knowing these, well, I call them Sharia supremacists, tended to dominate these no-go zones and made them, essentially, areas that the authorities, let alone the citizens of these various countries, dare not enter. I want to ask you, and we'll pick it up after the break, but I want to ask you, Soren, knowing the mindset, knowing the doctrinal underpinnings of Sharia and the supremacism that it obliges its adherence to practice, how are they perceiving this double standard, this privileged treatment that their populations are receiving in Spain and France and elsewhere? We'll pick that question up with Soren Kern of the Gatestone Institute right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're talking in this hour with Soren Kern, one of the most, I think, astute of chroniclers, if you will, of observers, of analysts of the dynamics that we're seeing, particularly in Europe, but there and much else of the free world, as I call it. Soren, we were talking before the break a bit about the population of mostly unassimilated, mostly Muslim, mostly illegal immigrants in parts of Europe, and how they've been given preferential treatment in country after country in terms of the lockdown in some cases, in terms of benefits of other kinds. And I was asking about how the individuals, particularly the Sharia supremacists among them in these communities, are likely to perceive the kind of treatment they're getting. I had a conversation about this with Robert Spencer recently, but I'd be very interested in your take on it, particularly from the European perspective.
Sure. My view is that this is just going to exacerbate the problem of sort of a, you know, parallel legal system in Europe, one based on Sharia and one based on normal civil constitutional law. The article that you referred to by Guy Millière, a recent article about the riots in France and the no-go zones, it is full of links to original sources in the French media. And really, I would encourage the listeners who are interested in this topic to just click on those. They're all in French, but there's the Google Translate. And you can really see the disdain with which not just the Muslim leaders, but the people in general, the general Muslim population, the immigrant population, have for police, for the state, for any type of authority. It's really shocking to me. And it's not just in the suburb, but it's also like in, for example, in some of the northern districts of Paris, the 18th district, for example. The way the whole city of Paris is under lockdown, but in that particular district, which is a very heavily migrant district, are just allowed to do what they want. They spit at the police, they curse at the police, they are physically abusive to the police. And essentially, it's not even limited anymore to the outer suburbs of Paris, but actually the city itself. And so I see really this leniency, this fear that European publics, and particularly the French government, have. You know, these Sharia leaders, these Muslim leaders, are very aware. They can see the fear. Fear is really driving the immigration policy in Europe and the leniency. And I think that they're just going to continue to take advantage of this from here on out. We're really going to see the increase of this double standard.
In his piece, and I commend all of our listeners, Gatestone Institute is a wonderful resource. I believe it's gatestoneinstitute.org. Soren Kern, our guest today, is, as I say, a frequent contributor to its pages, but Guy Millière has done a very troubling account in the past week or so of what's happening in France, and I think it's especially important to take this information aboard. But he contemplates rather explicitly and cites others who do as well, Sorin, the prospect of civil war basically being, if not inevitable, highly likely and becoming more so as a result of all of this. Do you agree?
I do. I think that this coronavirus crisis is going to create an economic shockwave that most Europeans alive today have never experienced before. And I think that there's a real danger that the governments are going to lose control, that there's going to be civil disobedience on a mass scale, that there will be revenge attacks against minority groups and Muslims and vice versa. I see this thing as being very, very fragile, not just France, but Spain as well, and even parts of Germany. And it's really this coronavirus, the economic repercussions of this are going to be so great that I'm really fearful that the state apparatus, the police security apparatus, is going to lose control. We're going to see some violence here, political violence, sectarian violence. It's going to become much more commonplace, I think, in the very near future.
So many things that I want to talk with you about. I do want to get to some of your writings about China and its penetration of Europe, but maybe to stay with this political theme for another moment, Soren Kern. We are hearing in the aftermath of Brexit and in the face of the coronavirus, I think rather more talk, more urgent conversation about essentially the end of the European experiment, the so-called bureaucracy in Brussels running the continent, until now Britain as well, and Ireland. When you look at the prospects of the sort of violent reactions or economic privation that might play into civil disobedience and disorder and so on, is one of the things that may well flow from all of this a reversion to something that the European Unionists have often warned about, that Europe would revert to some of its past, well, its most common condition, which is sort of fratricidal bloodletting between the countries of Europe and peoples within that those countries in some cases as well?
The coronavirus crisis has really exposed many myths that have been built up over the last 50, 60 years about European unity, about European solidarity. And this has been a major, major singular failing of the European Union. Their inability or unwillingness to help each other, to close the borders, to prevent economic help from the northern European countries to the southern European countries. So I think really a lot of eyes have been opened. I'm not so fearful of sectarian violence in terms of Germany versus Spain versus France, but I'm actually very happy to see that there's a new focus on national sovereignty. There's a desire to draw back some of the sovereignties that have been given to unelected bureaucrats in Brussels. And we're seeing a debate right now about the role of the European Central Bank and who actually makes the rules. Is it the nation state? Is it Germany? Or is it unelected bureaucrats in Brussels or wherever? So I think that's one of the positive outcomes of this whole thing, is really I think that there's going to be a reassessment of the European Union and what it stands for. There's going to be a desire by many nation states to reassert sovereignty on major issues. So I see that as sort of a, you know, if you can really say that there's a positive aspect to the coronavirus, which I don't want to downplay the gravity of it, but it is really that this globalization has really come to a preaching halt. And I think that there's a new focus on nationalism, a positive kind, obviously.
No, I did want to just ask you to drill down on that, because you've sort of touched on this a couple of times, that far-right parties, you called them nationalists, others have called them possibly becoming ascendant in the aftermath of this. How do you see, Soren Kern, the balance being struck between those who are simply, like I would argue Donald Trump has done, trying to restore sovereignty to their nation and the will of the people that are being ruled, you know, by representatives of those people instead of these unaccountable bureaucrats, whether it's in Washington or whether it's in Brussels. And on the one hand, and on the other, you know, the possibility that this thing leaves the rails with, you know, a much more, shall we say, intolerant and dangerous element that has fused nationalism in the past for malign purposes.
Sure, I think that everything really depends now on the elections that will happen after the coronavirus crisis is over. We see, for example, that President Macron in France, 62% of French people in the latest poll do not trust him to manage the crisis properly. There's a massive amount of resentment against the Socialist Communist Coalition government here in Spain, even among socialists, even among mainstream socialists, because this government has really moved very, very far to the left on many issues. So I think that this really is an opening for, you know, these populist parties, these are nationalist parties who want to reassert national sovereignty from unelected bureaucrats. There are always going to be some extreme far-right parties who are neo-Nazi parties. And I'm not talking about those parties. I'm talking about these populist parties who say this mass migration, globalization, transferring national sovereignty to unelected bureaucrats in Brussels has gone too far. I'm talking about the Brexit type of nationalism. And I think that we'll see after the elections, these next couple of years, we'll see how Marine Le Pen and other sort of nationalist parties in Central Europe do. But I see really that this is a turning point because millions of people are suffering, and the suffering hasn't even begun yet in earnest because so far the state has been able to provide payments. But these states, Spain is essentially a bankrupt country, and the northern European countries do not want to help Italy and Spain. These have always been spending well beyond their means. These countries probably should not even be in the Eurozone, and that's a whole other issue. Is the Eurozone going to break up? My sense is that Spain and Italy do not belong in the Euro. They don't have the same economic capacity to compete on equal terms with the northern European countries. And I think that one of the consequences of this really is that these southern European countries are going to go back to their national currency that allows them to devalue the currency and to deal with the debt crisis that is coming.
I imagine Greece would fall into this category as well. In this milieu, there is another factor, and you've written about it brilliantly as well, Soren Kernan. We're going to turn to that topic when we come back after this final break. China, what is it up to, and what does it mean for Europe and the free world more generally? That and much more with a distinguished senior fellow of the Gatestone Institute, Soren Kern. Straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this important and, I think, quite sobering conversation with Soren Kern of the Gatestone Institute. Soren, as I mentioned before the break, among the other things that you've been tracking closely in your inimitable skilled style is what China is doing at the moment. Having inflicted upon Europe and the rest of the world this, well, Chinese Communist Party virus, it seems to be very aggressively trying, nonetheless, to come out of the crisis in an even more dominant position in Europe. And I would just ask you to sort of characterize the role China is playing at the moment and what its ambitions for Europe seem to be.
Sure, China for a long time has been trying to split the West. It's been trying to draw Europe, the European Union, into its orbit and separate it from the United States. It's been largely successful at that, largely because most European leaders today are more concerned about the economic aspects than about the values of what the West represents. I think the similar dynamic is at play with Western leaders being afraid of Islam. Western leaders, I should say European leaders, are extremely afraid of upsetting China. The German government, the French government, the European Union have all essentially been silent on China's responsibility for this. All this defective medical equipment, I mean, millions and millions of pieces of defective medical equipment that European countries have had to pay for in advance. When these shipments come here, they're unusable, unreturnable, total loss. And then the Chinese diplomats here in Europe are essentially criticizing the European states for complaining about the quality of the Chinese product. And so what I think really is that particularly Germany here is so dependent on China for its economic growth, economic well-being, that unless there is a concerted effort by Angela Merkel to really start to decouple German industry from China, that once this virus is over, that these links between China and the European Union will continue. I think that there's extreme amount of pressure on Angela Merkel by the German car manufacturers, particularly Mercedes and when Volkswagen, because these are as a massive market for these companies. There is going to be Germany takes over the rotating presidency of the EU in July for the last 6 months of 2020, and there had been planned a major EU-China summit in Leipzig in September. Due to the coronavirus, this conference is now going to be by video conference. President Xi is not going to be coming to Germany in September. But I think that, I think that the European governments are very afraid of upsetting China, and they're trying to put under the rug the issues about Taiwan, about human rights violations in China, all of basically fear. And I think China is reading this very clearly, just the way the Muslim Sharia leaders in Europe are reading the fear of European leaders.
One other manifestation of this, Soren, and I don't know how closely you're tracking the particulars of it, but it's sort of symptomatic of the larger problem you've just described so well, and that is the penetration by China of the so-called 5G, fifth generation mobile networks of the various countries of Europe. Can you give us a sense as to whether there's any second thoughts being expressed? We've heard some out of Britain, but more generally in Europe, in the wake of this pandemic, about the idea of being so dependent upon China for something as vital as telecommunications, to say nothing of, this sort of digital backbone of the so-called Internet of Things that is apparently in the offing.
Sure. Earlier in the year, Boris Johnson in the UK allowed Huawei, the Chinese telecom company, to have a role in the development of the 5G network in the UK. That came under extreme criticism from President Trump, as well as from conservatives in Parliament. Due to the coronavirus and really the way the Chinese have dealt with this, there's growing pressure in the British Parliament to revisit that. But in lockstep, the Chinese authorities are issuing threats against the British government. It's going to be very hard for Boris Johnson, who is trying to exit the EU with some kind of a new treaty that governs trade with the European Union, because essentially, the UK is very dependent on China. Another case in point really is France. France has always resisted having Huawei play a role in this. And in February, there was a massive campaign by the Chinese government threatening Chinese telecom companies in China. They're saying if you don't allow Huawei to have a role in the 5G in France, we're going to block the activities of the European telecoms companies, particularly French companies in China. And so a few weeks ago, very quietly, the French government conceded, and they did give Huawei a role in supplying infrastructure for the 5G network. And I think basically that Spain is going to come under the same pressure, and you're going to see Germany also bowing to that pressure. Essentially, the European countries are let's just say China, for whatever, they're masters at using hardball tactics to get their way. And the Europeans, who have always been so focused on soft power and on diplomacy, and, you know, Europeans are so much better than the Americans in terms of dealing with diplomacy vis-a-vis China. The Europeans are no match for the Chinese. And until really there's a concerted effort by particularly Germany to start to relocate production out of China, whether it's India or whether it's bringing some of that stuff back to the European continent, the Chinese are going to continue to play hardball. And the Europeans are really in a very, very weak position at this point.
Let me just ask you in closing, you mentioned that one of the strategic objectives of China, Soren, is dividing the West. There are a few things that would more, I think, effectively do that than causing a rift between the security services of the United States and its European allies, specifically with respect to intelligence sharing and cooperation on security matters. The dependence on Huawei of some of these nations, and you've mentioned several that are important, you know, parts of our NATO alliance, the Germans, the French, the Brits. The Trump administration has made very clear, as you know, that it will be unable to share intelligence information if the European nations go down this road of enabling Huawei essentially to have access to the means by which such information would be shared, the communications of them at the very least. Give us a sense, if you would, Soren, you're talking to an American audience, very interested in national security matters, of how you see this playing out in terms of the future of the United States and its longstanding and, I think, important contribution to the security of Europe.
Sure. I think the utmost importance is that President Trump gets the economy back up and running in the United States, because the United States can only lead if it's an economic powerhouse. And really, I cannot stress the importance of that, because if there's any wavering on the side of the Americans, the Europeans are going to waver as well. I think that aside, there are a lot of European politicians, particularly in Social Democrats, who love China more than they love America. It's quite astonishing the level of anti-Americanism throughout this coronavirus crisis in the European press, even though European governments themselves have been largely inept at handling this crisis. And so now, for example, in Germany, in the middle of this crisis with China, the Socialist Party, the Social Democrats, are calling for the United States to remove nuclear weapons from German territory. So you can see really that these left-wing governments in Europe are essentially Marxist-driven in their ideology, and there's such a hatred for capitalism, and it's compounded by a dislike of President Trump. He says things the way they are. He says things in a non-diplomatic style. He says Europeans should pay. They're part of NATO. They've been not doing their part for a very long time, and that creates a lot of resentment in Europe, because they know that President Trump is right in this regard. So I see really is that there's an ideological divide here in Europe, and the younger generation, who's really been through the socialist-driven university systems and school systems, increasingly are agnostic on the issue of democracy, of liberal democracy.
Soren, there's so much more to talk with you about, but it won't be for today, I'm afraid. We've gone through this hour very impressively, as always, and I appreciate your time. I hope you'll visit with us again soon, as indispensable to our understanding of the part of the world that you cover so well at Gatestone Institute and again at the Strategic Studies Group in Spain. Come back to us, though, soon, if you would. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.